All right, well, good afternoon, everybody. This is Corey Worden, and you're listening to the ASSP Healthcare Practice Specialties Health Beat Podcast, and we appreciate you joining us today. Today, we've got an excellent episode coming up. Today, we got Abby Ferry, who is not only a veteran safety professional and has done a great amount of work as a safety pro and as a consultant, but she's also a very active ASSP leader and recently a multi-level award winner. So we're very happy to have her on today, and she's got a lot of great perspectives to give us. So short of me speaking for you, Abby, if you would, if you can give our listeners a little bit about yourself, your experiences, education, professional knowledge, all that good stuff, we appreciate it.
Definitely. So thanks for having me here too. It's cool that different ASSP groups and communities are embracing the podcast platform. So I think that's really exciting. So going back, going way back on education, I have come to the safety profession through the education route. So I got my master's degree in environmental health and safety from the University of Minnesota, Duluth. And I love that area, but I had to get out of the bold north. I needed to see different parts of the country. So I took my first job in Southern California and stayed out there for over 10 years in various roles that always kind of pointed back to construction. So my first role was with a construction company as their safety director. Then I got into risk control, but still focusing on construction, and weaved in and out of construction in different roles, and also worked for the Associated General Contractors here in Minnesota as their safety director. So lots of different roles in safety with different perspectives, but always, like I said, leaning towards construction, except for when I consulted on my own for about 8 years. And that's when I realized I really needed to diversify what I was doing. And so I started to work with other industries apart from construction and worked for some different craft breweries here in the Minneapolis area. So that was pretty cool. And just other general industry types of settings, manufacturing, oil and gas, retail, restaurants, hospitality. So really just tried to learn a lot about a bunch of different industries. But I always go back to, I feel that construction can really prepare you for anything. So I kind of wear that badge of honor, you know, I've got that construction experience and I can take that to any setting. And just always trying to expand the different perspectives from the worker perspectives that I could see through these different industry experiences. So now I'm back in insurance and risk control, and I'm thinking about maybe pursuing another certification or just something different on the educational piece, because I've always maintained my own professional development, but I'm thinking, okay, might be time to add something to that mix. So that's what I'm doing. That's where I came from, and that's where I am now.
Yeah, it's fantastic. Definitely a lot of experience and qualifications. You know, it's interesting. I like how you talk about that with the applicability, you know, and even when you're focused on a certain industry like construction or whatnot, the applicability is always there. And that's something that's very, very interesting among a lot of our members with the healthcare practice specialty, is that a lot of us may have begun in a different field, such as construction or manufacturing or chemicals or oil and gas or whatnot. And then somewhere in that journey, there was an opportunity to go into healthcare. And it's interesting because in the healthcare industry, a lot of times safety, you know, is divided. You have your what they consider to be employee safety, then you have your patient safety, then you have your infection prevention and control, and then you have your facility safety, which falls under facilities engineering and whatnot. So the applicability there means that we can take everything that we know, even from industries that aren't necessarily, you know, considered in the wheelhouse of healthcare, and apply all those lessons learned so that everybody can benefit from that. So over the years, what are some of those What are some of those things that you've seen, going from things like construction and risk management, insurance and whatnot? What are some of those overall lessons learned that you've been able to apply across the board?
Well, I was just thinking as you were describing about the different paths people have taken to get to healthcare safety, and a couple things. One, you all deal with patient safety, or some of you might deal with that. And I think for some of us that are safety professionals that have worked in different industries, I feel like that's one element that we all kind of want to stay away from. So I don't know if maybe you can help me with that, or maybe the healthcare practice specialty can help with that. But I think that's one of the reasons why when people see healthcare as a discipline within safety, that it's like, ooh, I'm good with the worker stuff. Like I think I can transfer my skills from another industry to the worker safety. But then there's the patient safety aspect that's kind of out there. But as far as the different roles that I've had, I really think that the common, I mean, I don't want to say common denominator, but the universal theme is just people. And so as you were talking about the applicability to different industries, I was just thinking in my head, like the workers are, it's all people. And so I think the safety professional field where we can shine or where we see we have our greatest challenges is because we deal with trying to influence people to do the things they need to do to keep themselves and others from being seriously injured or killed. And this is serious business day after day, but how are we communicating that severity, message every single day? You can't be a super serious person every single day, right? And but some days and some challenges, they will require you to be, very serious and very down to business. But I think, and as we've learned over the past year with COVID and doing a lot of things virtually, is that people need different pathways for communication. So it's up to us to understand the task at hand and the people we're working with and how they need to be communicated to best so that we can all get that best result that we're looking for.
Absolutely. I totally agree with that. It's good how you put that as well with the interpersonal communication and the overall communication of the hazard and the risk and the expectations for hazard controls is with healthcare. And I'm thinking this may be similar. I've only done construction for about a year. We did a project and it was a construction that went into a manufacturing. So I was kind of a hybrid. We built the factory, then we put the factory into operations. And so my construction experience is relatively limited. But with healthcare, the communication is really important there for two reasons. The first one is that, everybody's time is so constrained and compressed where everybody's constantly, tending for multiple patients or they're doing lab work or they're doing pharmacy or they're trying to do maintenance on the facility. And so getting everybody together to do any kind of group communication is difficult or impossible sometimes. And so then we're able to adapt and figure out ways that we can do it effectively. And also with emails, a lot of the times the nurses may have an email account, but they may only look at it once a week, and then when they do, it's going to see, okay, well, what computer-based training am I required to do right now? They'll knock that out real quick and then get back to their patients. So it's not a lot of time like you'd see in an office environment. So I'm thinking that may be similar to construction. What are some of the best practices that you've seen on communication and ways to get those messages across when people are constantly moving and constantly involved in different tasks?
So I want to talk about the time thing first, and I wish I saved this reference because I think about it all the time, that it's not so much that everyone's experiencing a time crunch, but it's even that perception of a time crunch that can really mess with your head and make a worker make the wrong decision or the decision that we did not train on. So I always think about that because especially in construction, it's you know, a project is measured by, you know, was it delivered on time and under budget and quality and no injuries or, you know, some other metric that we're measuring in regards to safety. And even on a project that's super well managed and maybe communication is pretty good, you know, better than average, that's still the worker just by nature of being in, and I'll just pick on construction, the nature of being in construction and what society thinks construction projects are all about, that the worker thinks I'm under pressure, you know, every single day. And so that perception, even if their project manager or superintendent or foreman is not pressuring them on time, they still have this perceived pressure, and that still can contribute to just some awkward decision-making. And like I mentioned, decision-making that isn't what we trained on. So I think that's like, we have to think about psychology of people, right? And I think that's why safety professionals get a little stressed out or a little misguided, is because we're, again, going back to the influence, we have so much that we're doing in this communication and influence that really traditional safety professional development in the past wasn't giving us the tools that we needed. We needed to draw upon tools from psychology and from sales and marketing and organizational psychology and how teams work and things like this. So it's a lot. So I forget your original question, and I'm sorry that I answered a different question, my own question. But I think we still need to consider that psychology aspect of things.
No, that's great. You definitely got into it. Yeah, with the communication, I totally agree. You know, the best practice is there. If we try to always fall back on, you know, the traditional paradigms, you know, we're gonna get everybody in the same room and we're gonna do a safety briefing. You know, a lot of times that may not be feasible, or may not be effective even. And just like, you know, well, we're gonna send an email. A lot of times people may not read it, or they may read it and not digest it or internalize it. So if we're able to, like you said, you know, pull from those best practices elsewhere, you know, we can certainly find improvements. I know that one of the things that we've always talked about is that, you know, within the human resources community, they always say that you should reinforce something 100 different times. And so, of course, if you're thinking about that, if somebody hears it, you know, in a meeting or in a training session, then they see it on a bulletin board and they get an email, they're hitting for all these different directions, then eventually they'll start to internalize it. But then you've also got the education community, and they'll say that people need to hear something 7 times, 7 ways. So, you know, for example, you hear it, like we said, you know, in a briefing or in an email, on a bulletin board, and or on a podcast or a webinar. You know, there are all these different mediums and forums. So the idea is, you know, the consistency and the frequency and the recurring nature of it. So I totally agree with that.
Yeah, it's like you're using how, like a social media platform like LinkedIn or even Facebook, about how they do their algorithms, right? Like they see that you're looking at this, so they give you this ad, or they give you this person's feed comes up first, and you don't even see some of your people that you're actually friends with. You don't see their feed because you haven't engaged with it. So it's almost like taking that algorithm mindset and applying it to how you're communicating with people. And I totally agree. I think we've got so many different communication tools at our disposal that sometimes people, you know, they get overwhelmed and then they just think, oh, I have to pick one. So I'm going to post these things on a bulletin board that the workers are going to see. Well, like you said, what was it, 7 times, 7 ways, or reinforcing 100 times? That's one thing. So, you know, I hope people expand their definition of communication for the workforce and really take that to heart. I think those are great like mantras almost to keep in mind when communicating to workers. Because I think sometimes, like you said, people say, let's come in and have a safety briefing, and they think, okay, good, we covered that. And then they may not cover it or even talk about it or go even small talk about it with the worker for months, or maybe worse, until next year when that training is due again. So I think safety professionals should, we need to look at all these different opportunities, right? These are opportunities for communication, opportunities for micro reinforcement of what that training class just was, you know, they sat in for 8 hours. So I think looking at communication opportunities in a different way. I know when I started looking at it this way as opportunities, then I don't want to miss opportunities. So small talk is great, you know, how's the weather, how's the kids' soccer team, whatever. But when I'm talking to a worker or to a group of workers, that's a precious focused time and opportunity. So I want to make sure I'm using that time, no matter how brief, to do one of those 100 reinforcements. So I like that.
Yeah, definitely. I like how you put that with the comparison to the social media algorithms. You know, we're able to, you know, adapt as we figure out what's more effective. You know, then we can continue to get things going. That's actually how we came upon this podcast, was that our advisory board with the healthcare practice specialty, we had been talking about ways that we can communicate, and we were starting to realize, I'm sure you've heard these same conversations, you know, with ASSP in the last few months, is, you know, it's of course evident to everybody that because of the pandemic, there's been this, you know, tenfold increase in webinars and virtual platforms. And so we say, well, we're going to put this information on a webinar, and everybody kind of goes, oh, you know, collective, you know, sigh, oh, another webinar, yay, you know. Yep. So we say, well, you know, maybe a podcast people can listen to when they're driving or whatnot, and you don't have to be sitting in front of a computer. So that's to your point, that's kind of how we came up on that. And then same thing at work is, for National Safety Month, for example, you know, we do multiple different means of communication. And so with the National Safety Month, we thought, well, what are we going to do to make this different than every other month? And so we went to each of our major facilities, and we were able to put up a display with, you know, different information and different bulletins and little, I don't want to say incentives, but, you know, little giveaway promo items that we had. Thankfully, we had a few of those in backstock, but that way people, it would kind of pop out a little bit more. But the second part of that question I was going to ask you is, in addition to the communication itself, you know, the forums and the frequency and the consistency of it, you know, the content of the communication, where we're trying to impart the, here's the hazard, and here's the level of risk, you know, and here's the expectation for hazard control and safety. With healthcare, we have a lot of challenges with that because, you know, I'm thinking this is also similar to construction, because there's just so much frequency where even before COVID-19, you know, it's pretty consistent that we have patients who have, you know, respiratory illness such as, you know, severe influenza or tuberculosis or whatnot. And in the past, you know, we had the Ebola situation back in 2014. And so that's, I think for a lot of reasons, there were a lot of people when COVID-19 first came around in December, January of 2020, a lot of people kind of went, oh, it's another respiratory disease. You know, we've been doing this for a long time. And so the severity was, it took a while for people to understand the scope and scale of this pandemic. And same thing with a lot of other hazards, things like needle sticks, is people deal with needles so many times throughout each day that, you know, the thought of a needle stick isn't the same level of severity as it will be to somebody else who thinks, if I get stuck with a dirty needle, there's a 50-50 coin toss of an infectious disease exposure. It's a little bit daunting. Whereas a healthcare professional, they may have seen it so many times that it doesn't carry that same level of severity. So we're constantly trying to communicate that level of risk to make sure that people stay aware of it and they're able to take the right precautions. Have you ever encountered something like that where communicating the level of risk is a challenge?
Yeah. As you were describing that, I was thinking complacency, right? Like the usual response to that is complacency kills. And, you know, that the hazards that we're exposed to the most are the things that we become the most complacent about. And then that's when a super horrible, serious thing could happen because the risk is high. So when I think about that word complacency, in the past, I used to use that word a lot. And as I've grown as a safety professional, I see now how using the word complacency can it borders on or goes right into worker blame. And I don't personally want to operate that way where I'm defaulting to what's wrong with this worker. You know, they're complacent, they're forgetting everything they've learned. So I go back to the conversation we had just before that, where it's about meeting people where they are. Well, first identifying where they are, how they like to be communicated to, what their level of risk tolerance or how they perceive risk, because there's people that, like you said, the needle sticks, it's the worst thing that could happen. For other people, it's like, eh, you know, it's part of the job, I can figure it out, that sort of thing. So as many workers as we have at a workplace, that's how many different combinations or different ways we have of how people process and understand and then manage risk. So that's why one size fits all messaging just doesn't work. And it's not so much about communication to the group about risk and severity, but it's about identifying maybe smaller groups of people that are more closely aligned in how they approach risk and crafting the message specifically to them. So I know that's difficult, but it's worth it. And there's platforms out there that are starting to understand more about a worker based on their inputs into a system. So observation systems, platforms or software solutions that rely on worker observations. The artificial intelligence behind those platforms is really about understanding individual worker approaches to risk. And then what those platforms can help you do is better craft your messaging to the individual worker. So I'm hoping that these types of software solutions, I know I just went in a completely different direction, but I really am excited about software platforms that rely on worker observations and worker input into the system. I'm really hopeful that those are more widely adopted so that the cost can start to come down so that mid-size, family-owned, you know, smaller companies are able to start using those types of platforms, because I think the ability to gather that data and then act on that data in a way where a safety professional isn't having to crunch all that data, I think that's the key. And that's how we can move forward more quickly and effectively, with safety improvement.
Yeah, definitely, definitely. I totally agree with that. For two reasons. The first thing I was going to say is what you were referring to with the discussion about complacency and things of that nature. That's actually something very, very important that we talk about. I actually just spoke about this with our previous guest, Dr. Yule. We were talking about how, you know, when we do these incident analyses, and I'm sure you've seen this in your career as well, is, you know, you look at all the different factors that influenced the decision-making process, and then it feeds into whatever that work practice or whatever that decision was that was happening at the time of the incident, whether it's an exposure or an injury or whatnot. And when those things happen, there tends to be a little bit of a kickback where sometimes people will think that, like you said, you know, people may feel like it's a blame game or it's punitive against the employee or whatnot. And I always feel compelled to explain that, you know, all the intention of that is to figure out all the different factors that led into that and how we can positively adjust those factors to lead to a safer work practice. But it's not about pointing fingers or saying that somebody's at fault, because of course, you know, 99% of the time people have the best intentions and they're trying to do the right thing. It just didn't work out. And that's happened to me even in my life. So
Right.
I certainly empathize with that. So I totally hear you when you're discussing that. And then the second thing I was going to say is I like what you were talking about with the observations and the indicators there, because the leading indicators are just so important, you know, so that we can get proactive and figure out, get predictive. You know, we can figure out what those different conditions and work practices are that are affecting those incidents. And then we're able to positively influence those, way further to the left of the timeline. And so I always, at least in my experience, there's been, very, very little technology involved and very few processes. So it's really been a matter of starting at, square zero and explaining the intention of the, the predictive nature of it, saying that, well, if we're observing to see if we're doing, for example, if we're doing safe patient handling, then of course the fundamentals of that are, well, did we identify the risk of having a patient mobility? For example, if you have a bariatric patient that, if they weigh 350 or 400 pounds, and you have one nurse that's going to try to help this person move by themselves, there's a high probability of a back strain or worse. And so then the next question, well, do we have the expected safe work practice? And then if we do, okay, do we have the equipment to do that safely? Is the equipment available? Is it convenient? Is it accessible? Is it clean? Does it have a clean sling? And then did the employee make sure the patient was safe, then get the equipment in place, mobilize the patient using the equipment to prevent an injury? So if we're doing all those things, then each one of them lessens the risk of an injury. So could you tell us a little more? I'm interested because I haven't seen it myself. So with the software that's coming around, so would it be that the employees and the hospital leadership, they would fill in the data on what those observations were, and then the software would do the prediction and the analysis?
Yeah, so basically the more observations you put into these systems, the more that you kind of train the artificial intelligence that works in the background. So it's taking information from photos, from some of these systems use voice. So you don't even have to like interact with a device. You just speak into it and it understands your words and it finds the patterns. So really they're just finding patterns, and then they present you the pattern and the trend. And then it's up to you, as a safety professional to then make sense of that. But really the AI is able to give you a lot. So there's not a lot for you to have to then go and make sense of. So the best systems that I've seen that workers really latch onto are the systems that are simple. So the one that I've become familiar with that just takes voice into account and the workers just speak into it and do their own, on the spot risk assessment, that works out great because, like I said, the worker doesn't have to check boxes, fill in blanks, type out, a paragraph of what they think happened or a witness statement. So, and then the other systems that I like are the ones where you basically just take a photo and then add a caption, and that caption can tell you a lot about what the worker perceives was the risk or how to handle that risk or put in corrective actions for the next time, or maybe they're not a very, or they are a very risk tolerant person. So they may not catch the connection that based on this situation that they would have to put this control in next time. So sometimes the lessons lost on that person, but you're getting good information based on, or you're getting good information about how that worker processes risk. So there's a lot going on with these different platforms, and there's some that do some of what I've described and others that are, really full-fledged and very intelligent or artificially intelligent. So I would lean more towards the ones that are using AI that just, you're taking whatever the worker is going to feed into the system, and it's going to just crunch those patterns, like I said, and give you those trend reports. So the bottom line is that those software solutions are meant to keep safety professionals out there communicating and influencing the workers and not stuck in their office crunching spreadsheets or, trying to track and trend information based on written reports or even emailed or checklist types of things, but just really trying to limit the amount of time that the safety professional is doing the analysis and relying on AI to do that for you.
Yeah, that's cool. It's actually very interesting that we're talking about this, because I was actually just having a conversation just last week where we were talking about just what you just said about, how it's a balancing act, to be able to be in the field and do the, observations and the communication and be there, just the presence alone is such an important thing. And then then you're kind of forced to go, you know, retreat back to the computer and put in the information and make it into a documented, you know, sustainable format. Because of course, if you're out there talking and in case somebody doesn't hear it or they're not present at the time, then they don't get the message. So you want to document it and have it to where everybody can see it. But that takes time. Then at that time, you're not in the field and whatnot. So that's great. I think that will be a cool thing if those things continue to become more available and present. That's pretty cool.
Yeah. I just wanted to add to what you were saying about the incident investigation before, where you were giving very detailed, like, did they do this? Did they do this first? And that sort of thing. Because I think with incident investigation, a lot of times people are looking for like this spectacular outcome, like this smoking gun where it's like, aha, that's what happened. And so now we need to do this, this, and that, and everything's going to be great and we'll prevent it. And any incident investigation that doesn't end with this big aha outcome makes it a lame incident investigation. And so we end up doing a lot of lame incident investigations that aren't super exciting, but they actually are, because if we would really look at the information and we would see that you're finding those little things, like little process improvements, that it's like, okay, this just generated 6 to 8 different items that we could implement, you know, little things that happened that led up to the incident occurring. So that's why I think AI is an important piece of moving forward in the safety profession, is that often we're putting, I don't know what we're doing sometimes, we're putting our own, what's the right word, our own stereotypes, our own judgments, even safety professionals, you know, we're putting our own feelings into how we think an incident investigation should turn out, maybe, or what we should be looking for, or what the outcome might be. But the AI, it's just data. Like, it doesn't have feelings. You know, it's just going to analyze the trends and tell you, hey, this is what happened, or here's what could happen. So while I think obviously there's a place for humanity in all of this, I do think that in data and number crunching, we can have less humanity dealing with spreadsheets. And I think we can all agree that that would be a good thing. And then have more humanity in the implementation and the communication of what the AI is coming up with.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, that's also important. I like how you put that with, you know, the watching out for the potential, you know, for any kind of, whether it's inadvertent or not, you know, or subconscious bias in there, where I know, like when I was in the military in leadership and instructor training, we used to learn about, you know, you want to watch out for the halo effect, you know, where if you have the way they would describe it in the military is if you have a troop that, you know, they constantly look perfect, you know, their boots are shine. Well, they don't shine boots anymore, but back in the day, they would shine boots. The boots are shiny and their uniform is pressed and they have, you know, sharp salute and they just look the perfect part. We don't want that to influence the fact that when we do the evaluation, you know, if they don't know how to do their skills, then they don't know how to do their skills. You know, they look good doing it, so it's okay with me. You know, they're still gonna get hurt if they can't do it properly. And the flip side of that is, you know, you've got the halo effect, and on the other side, you've got the confirmation bias, where if you walk into it assuming that you think that person doesn't know what they're doing and, you know, they have a bad attitude and you think, well, there's no way they could possibly do this right, you know, and that doesn't mean that, you know, just because they don't look good and, you know, maybe they do have an attitude issue or whatnot, that doesn't mean they don't know their skills, you know. So we want to be able to give credit where credit's due, you know. So there's a lot of different variables in there to where we're able to make sure that we mitigate that bias wherever possible. So it sounds like that those AI solutions kind of work in that regard. That's cool stuff.
It is. And the cool thing is that it's real, you know, because sometimes I talk about these different software platforms that I've been able to see demonstrations of, and it's like, no way, that's really like that really works, you know, and it's really a system that's out there that employers can use. And there's a couple out there, I'll tell you after, there's a couple out there that it's like, oh, I wish that everybody could see this and that everybody could afford it and just implement it across the board. I mean, there's so many cool integrations that could happen as well. I mean, if there was some kind of understanding of a person's learning style and their learning development from even, you know, their high school years or some kind of assessment, that could help us have better means of communication with the worker once they come to our workplace. So there's a lot that can be done. And not even getting into the insurance and claims aspect, because all the stuff I've talked about is more proactive. But then if you throw in the history perspective and have claims data in these systems, then that can give you even more finer tuned data to act on. So it basically becomes a predictive analytics platform for you. So it's super exciting stuff. And I hope people that are in the day-to-day of safety and aren't on the consulting side or the insurance side like me, I hope people are able to seek out some of this information to understand what tools are available to them, because the cost really has come down. So I think the mindset of, oh, that's expensive, my company will never go for it, you never know, because these can integrate with so many other parts of the business too. Really, so just a quick side note, one of the platforms that I've seen a demonstration of, it actually has turned into more of a quality tool and a production tool, and then safety is the byproduct. So you never know how these systems are going to work out and what different elements of the business it'll impact.
Definitely, definitely. Yeah, that's important too. I like how you put that with the, you know, the quality, because we actually just had that conversation. It's interesting how everything ties together. You know, the world is a web of people and information, you know. We had just talked about that, because something as simple with our COVID-19 testing teams, you know, almost all of them operate outdoors. And if it rains, you've got the potential for a safety issue. If it's, you know, lightning or high winds, things of that nature, or you know, a tornado watch or whatnot. And then on the other side, you got a quality issue, because if it rains on your samples, then it can invalidate the sample or give a false negative or whatnot. And so we were talking about that with some of our team leaders, you know, is that if it rains, then you have to make a decision in real time where we say, okay, if it rains, am I thinking, is it going to be an immediate safety issue, such as we have lightning within 5 miles, or we have winds above 10 miles an hour, et cetera, or are there no safety issues present? We just have some drizzling rain, but that could become a quality issue that could invalidate the samples. Or is it raining to the point where it's a quality issue, and even though there's not lightning or high winds or other immediate hazards, it creates chronic discomfort and, you know, stressors, which can become a wellness or a psychological safety issue. And so, like you said there, the quality and the safety, you know, a lot of times they're just intrinsically connected.
Definitely. Yeah, it's not just like the safety first or safety is our first priority. It's, we're running a business here with goals and outcomes. And so we need to make sure we've got, you know, safety, productivity, quality, you know, sustainability, all this kind of stuff has to be in mind and part of the plan.
Yep. You know, it's interesting too. I'm actually writing an article. It's in mid draft right now, so it'll be done here pretty soon. But it's about just that. It's like you say, you know, we're doing a operation or running a business or whatever, and you know, we have objectives that we have to meet. So the article's premise is it possible, or, well, we all know it's possible, but how often does it happen to where, as safety professionals, we have to watch ourselves to make sure that we're not making the operation so safe that nothing else happens, you know, because right. Of course the safest thing to do is let's all just go home and not do anything, you know,
right.
but it's like you have to keep it within feasibility. And we saw a lot of that with the pandemic, where, you know, in any congregation at the height of a pandemic is a risk for disease transmission. And so the question becomes, well, we have to make it as safe as possible, knowing that there's going to be some risk there. And then we also have to make it as safe as possible so where we can still accomplish our objectives, because if we don't accomplish the objectives, then we don't get the COVID-19 testing done, then we don't have data, then we can't do contact tracing, and we can't figure out what the infection rate is, and that creates a bigger risk for the population at large. So it's all a balancing act there, to your point.
Yeah, and not every day is going to be so serious. You know, there's always competing priorities and a balancing act. And, you know, fortunately, in most of our businesses, they're not all life and death every minute of every day. So there is a balance. But yeah, I agree. There's a lot of factors that go into the decisions that we're hoping the workers make during, you know, each minute of each day.
Definitely. Yeah. Well, cool. So if you're up for it, we'll take a little veer to the our direction. Let's talk about ASSP.
Yeah.
So if you would tell our listeners what you've got going on with ASSP, because I know that there's a lot of crosstalk between healthcare practice specialty and WISE and your organizations.
Yeah, I'm trying to step back into the background and yeah. I'm trying to mentor and sponsor and bring up more leaders. And it's not even more leaders. It's just more, just bringing more people to the table. A lot of times, and we see this at the chapter level too, that it ends up being the same cast of characters that's doing all of the leadership types of activities. And we're not growing our own future leaders, even though I know that that's a main priority within ASSP, and we do have structures in place for that. But I think, especially within WISE, with our advisory committee, we definitely need to be intentional about making the invitation and telling people, hey, this is the type of volunteer leadership that we have available within, we'll just take WISE for an example. And not everybody wants to run to be the assistant administrator to administrator path, but there's a ton of other opportunity to lead on other levels as far as all the different initiatives that WISE has in place, and that we just keep moving along and moving forward and growing what we do. And it's because we're able to let people know the different volunteer opportunities out there and getting them in. That's the toughest part. So I think there's a, what's the right word? It's not a gap. It's not, I mean, there's just different generations that we have in place right now. I mean, we've got boomers, we've got Generation X, we've got millennials and Generation Z, and we all have different approaches to volunteer leadership. So for me, I almost lean towards like a boomer mentality, as far as, you know, volunteering builds your resume and that's just what you do. And contrast that with millennial and younger that I've reached out to for volunteer opportunities, and they want to know, well, what's the scope? What's the time commitment and things like that, because they may not have a leader at their organization that would support this type of activity. So it's important that as we reach out and say, oh, there's so much opportunity to volunteer and get involved, well, what is it? So you have to be very specific with what the opportunity is, what the direct ask is, what the commitment is, and make space for things like micro volunteering opportunities, where it's not that you're signing on for 4 years, which is the assistant admin to admin path, but that maybe there's something that comes up once a year and the volunteer commitment might be for 2 months, and we can rely on a small group of people to see that, whatever that thing is, through. So I'm trying to work on this with my chapter too, and working on that with WISE as well when I was administrator, but just to help identify those support roles that can then develop into maybe a greater role if somebody wants to do that.
Yeah, that's fantastic. I totally agree with that. You know, it's, I always have to remind myself that, you know, like you just said, when we ask for volunteers or for people to engage with us and get involved with the different practice specialties or the chapters or whatnot, then there's, unless we're very clear about what we're asking for, you know, there's a chance that people could assume that we're asking them to take on something that's going to take, you know, 30 hours a week of their spare time, if anybody has any spare time anymore, you know. And then a lot of times people, they go, well, I'm going to get as far away from that as I can. You know, I don't need another job, especially an unpaid job. And so if we're very clear about what's going on, then people might be more receptive. So we've been trying to do the same where we're, you know, we have the different roles with the advisory board, you know, such as the, like Holly had just taken our membership chair role. And, you know, we said, okay, well, these are the expectations. And she said, well, yeah, I can do that. You know, so it worked out well. And then we've also created a lot of these different initiatives, you know, so like with the podcast, you know, if people want to be involved with being on a podcast panel to talk about a hazard, or if they want to write a paragraph or two for an article, you know, then it gives people a way to get involved without, you know, being any kind of overwhelming commitment. So that's great. I know y'all have a lot of good stuff going on there.
Yeah, like basically take all the activities that you would need to get to that gold level, you know, if you're a community, or platinum level if it's a chapter, and then go work yourself backwards. You know, how can we have a committee around this particular activity where there's a lead person, and then maybe a co-lead, and then a small subcommittee. And that's how WISE really works all of our initiatives, is that you see the advisory committee members on the website, assp.org/WISE, but behind each of those advisory committee positions is a subcommittee of people that are working on the thing, you know, whatever that thing is. It's not just the one person is left having to do everything for, let's say, awards and honors. You know, that's a working, functioning subcommittee that gets together on their own, and they report to the larger advisory committee meeting. And sometimes, you know, as an administrator, I don't know every single thing that that group is doing, but I know I can count on them to do what we need to do to get that gold level.
Yeah, definitely. And that's the thing. I'm very happy about the way that the CAMPT has come about, because it outlines, you know, here's everything you need to do. And then you can, like you said, work backwards and reverse engineer, break those things down into objectives and initiatives, and then assign people to them or ask for volunteers. And then, you know, just systematically plan it out and take care of it. So I think it's pretty cool stuff. So with all that, fantastic conversation. You know, we talked about, of course, your experiences and your career. We talked about a lot of these different different factors that go into being a safety pro and a consultant: communication, technology, leading indicators, huge stuff. We talk about ASSP. So if you take all that, you know, and of course all things we didn't talk about, which could fill a book, if you take all that stuff. So let's say somebody came up to you and they said, well, hey, you know, Abby, I want to go into safety. Or if they said, you know, I'm in safety, but I want to be a safety leader. What kind of advice would you give them on things to look for, things to learn, different opportunities? What would you ask them to look for?
I mean, definitely getting involved. You know, this is an ASSP podcast, so strongly suggest people get involved with either their local chapter, their region. With how everything's been virtual, it's a lot easier to get involved. So I think people should look for those opportunities. Something I like to advise people on too is that a lot of us, because we scroll through LinkedIn, we see the different influencers out there, or see, you know, maybe another safety professional that you look at their posts and you're like, oh, they're doing some cool stuff. So, you know, LinkedIn is there for a reason. So go look at that person's profile, look at their work experience, look at their volunteer experience, and see where they've been to get to where they are. And that can give you some ideas on professional development or education, or maybe there's a commonality that maybe you both worked at the same company years ago or went to the same college, and just reach out to that person. So I think within ASSP, there's lots of opportunities for mentoring. So I advise becoming a mentor and getting a mentor. A lot of the different practice specialties and common interest groups, they'll do short-term mentoring if there's a specific task or a specific issue that you have. Maybe you're coming up to negotiate salary, or you're navigating a job change because you're moving out of the country, or you're coming back. And so reach out to those groups. They'll pair you with someone that can help you kind of, you know, get you through that thing, whatever it is. So I strongly suggest that. I think, gosh, you know, the cliche is networking. So, you know, mentoring can be a formalized way to network, but I think reaching out to people through social media or through the ASSP community that are people that you look up to, or maybe just want to learn a little bit more about a particular job they held in the past because you're working through something like that now. I think if you're going to reach out to someone cold like that, whether it's LinkedIn or the community or some other way, I think it's important for you to do a little bit of homework so you have a specific ask. Because I do get people that reach out to me and say, hey, I want to learn more about being a consultant. And I just think, well, you know, I've got this website I've maintained for years where I've written a lot of blogs about it. So I put together those blog posts into one super blog post. So when people ask me that question, I send them that and say, hey, check this out. You know, let me know if you have any specific questions after you do. And sometimes they come back and have some really thoughtful questions and we talk about it. And sometimes they don't, because maybe they weren't really serious about the question or serious about what was behind what they were asking. So I think if you're going to network in the virtual space, that it's very important you do your homework, because we're all getting emails, text messages, Teams invites and messages and Jabber messages and LinkedIn DMs and our personal email and work email. And there's just a lot of noise out there. But if you come through with a thoughtful question and a genuine ask for connection, usually people are going to take you up on that, because we understand, especially safety professionals, understand how we play a role in growing our profession and ensuring that this, you know, knowledge that a lot of us that have been in the profession have, that that's passed on to the next generations.
I totally agree. And there's been, it's funny, I like how you put that, where, you know, it's always good to reach out, and, you know, if you have specific information that you're seeking or an opportunity that you're asking about, then those things are always beneficial, you know. And a lot of times it's mutually beneficial. You know, I know if people reach out to me and they'll ask about the healthcare practice specialty, or if, you know, if they're looking for information about healthcare safety or whatnot, then I think about that as, you know, if I'm able to help, then I'm always happy to. And then the other thing is, if that person's interested in getting involved, then that's great for, you know, succession planning and getting more people on board and all of that good stuff. So
yeah, funny. that's when it's helpful to have those micro volunteer opportunities ready in your back pocket to say, hey, thanks for joining the chapter, or thanks for joining the common interest group or practice specialty. We've got, you know, this pretty low commitment thing that if you want to check this out, like, I'm happy to make the connection. So I think that's where then those systems can come together and really help with that succession planning.
Yeah, absolutely. Definitely. That's what I was going to say, is it's funny, because sometimes people will reach out, you know, and they'll say, you know, I'm interested in this opportunity. And I always tell my wife, I say, well, you know, I hope they're serious, because I'm about to open up a lot of things here.
Right. Have I got something for you?
Yeah. Which one would you like to be involved in? You know,
right.
And to your point, you know, I always try to keep it reasonable. You know, I say, would you like to write three paragraphs for this article, or would you like to be on this panel, or do a portion of this webinar, you know, but
or even just asking them, you know, what would you like to do? Like, do you want to work on your speaking? Do you want to work on your writing? Do you want to meet more people? And then you can help fine tune the volunteer ask based on what their actual interests are, because chances are, if it's something they're actually interested in, they may stick with it.
Yeah, definitely. That's a great point. You know, there's a chance if somebody, you know, wants to get involved and you say, well, we have this article, and in their head they're thinking, that's my least favorite thing I do is write, you know, then they probably, never mind, you know. But if they really like public speaking, they may be in for a podcast or a webinar or leading a portion of the advisory board call, or, you know, a lot of different opportunities. And that's fantastic. Well, cool. Well, heck, I know you're very busy, so I don't want to keep you on here all day, but is there anything else you'd like to add today before we tie it up?
I think this was fun. So I'm hopeful that other practice specialties and common interest groups might take this as inspiration to do something similar to communicate to the members. So, but if they don't, you know, I am co-host of a podcast that people can listen to as well right after this one. It's Safety Justice League, and you can find it anywhere that you would usually listen to podcasts. And I really do hope that people are able to find some volunteer opportunities that match what they're looking for, because that's what really makes ASSP membership awesome, is being able to work together on a team to accomplish something that then becomes something you can earn an award for, or that you can publish something in the PSJ, or, you know, something like that, just to get something out there in that whole body of knowledge space that exists for our profession. There's a lot of opportunities.
Absolutely. You know, that's one thing to echo what you're saying here. One thing I love about ASSP is that, you know, when I was, let's see, I got out of the Air Force, or I shouldn't think got out. I completed my enlistment in 2009. Then I came home in 2010. And then I got my first private sector job in 2010. So it's been, 11 years of that. And then before that, the military. And so for a lot of that time, especially in the military, because, you know, you had that very clear hierarchical structure, you know, very clear chain of command, that, you know, you a lot of times you feel like, well, this is my place, you know, I'm supposed to do this job in this place, and I'm not supposed to go outside that box. So coming, when I finished with the military and came back home and started working, it took me a minute to realize that, you know, I didn't have to stay in that place. You know, I wasn't no longer, you know, Sergeant Warden in this chain of command and this place on the totem pole, you know. So ASSP enabled me to be able to get involved and start doing a lot of stuff. And so I think it's great when people want to do that. I'm always happy to help with that. And I totally agree with what you're saying there.
Awesome. And thank you for your service, of course.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. But lastly, but before we wrap up, I do want to congratulate you. I know you just received a number of awards and accolades this year. Can you tell our listeners what they are?
Oh my gosh. So I was awarded my chapter Safety Professional of the Year award and submitted an application or nomination for the region SPY as well. And so I was awarded that. I was also awarded the WISE SPY, and also, so as part of that, then the nomination goes up to the COPS, the Council on Practices and Standards, SPY, and I was awarded that as well. So 4 SPY awards. And from my understanding, I am also nominated or considered for Society SPY as well. So that's kind of, that's exciting to be in the running. So 4 SPY awards this year, which is a little ridiculous, but pretty awesome. And it's been, I've been involved in ASSP since I was a student. So it's been a part of my professional life, and I've given a lot and have brought a lot of people into the fold, and I'm excited to keep that up. And so it's cool to be awarded, you know, during your career when you're actually, you know, doing the things. So I thank all of those groups for recognizing what I've contributed and giving me those honors. It's awesome.
Yeah, that is awesome. You've done an outstanding amount of work and great leadership. So we appreciate all that, and certainly congratulations.
That's, thank you.
Oh, yeah, heck yeah, good reason to celebrate.
That's right.
Definitely. But, you know, so I was going to say here before we tie up, as always, you know, you have an open invitation if you want to come back and talk more, or if you want to be on one of our panels. So we always talk about, you know, different hazards and best practices. So if there's anything in particular you'd like to like to jump in on, you're always welcome. But otherwise, I certainly appreciate your time today and all your knowledge and expertise. It's been great talking to you. So for everybody listening, in case you're not familiar, the healthcare practice specialty, we have a lot of stuff coming up. So we have a webinar that's going to be on July 16th. We're going to be talking about workplace violence prevention, and that's going to be from Ms. Linda Enos, and she's going to be talking about best practices as well as some of the different standards and regs that are coming around from like Joint Commission and OSHA and whatnot. And then, of course, in August, on August 13th, we're going to be talking about occupational health and what goes on in the occupational health clinic and how they can partner with safety. And that's going to be with some of the great leaders from the Association for Occupational Health Professionals. And then we'll have some more come up in the fall. Otherwise, on our podcast, which you're listening to now, we're on anchor.fm/ASSP-HCPS-HealthBeat. And we have a lot of great episodes, such as today's episode with Abby. And then we also had one that we did with Dr. Nancy Yule. And we had one before that with Dr. Melissa Gresham. And then several before that. So please check us out. And as always, if you have any questions, concerns, comments, complaints, or if you'd like to get involved, as always, please feel free to reach out. We're on LinkedIn under ASSP Healthcare Practice Specialty. And we're also on the ASSP communities. So definitely feel free to reach out and we'll be happy to get you involved like we've been talking about today. But otherwise, we appreciate you listening and we'll talk to you real soon.